Okay, welcome everyone. Welcome back to what is episode 28 of the Academy of Management's Origin series, the podcast and video interview series in which we try and go behind the curtain of AMR papers and chat with the authors about how those papers have evolved and developed and where the ideas came from and how they eventually found their way to coming into print at the Academy of Management Review. For this episode, I've got the privilege and honor of talking to Emily Feldman and Zeke Hernandez about their fascinating paper entitled Synergy in Mergers and Acquisitions, Typology, Life Cycles, and Value. And I'm just going to say from the outset, it's probably the wrong thing for me to say as the host of a podcast series of AMR papers, but this is one of the most thorough, theoretically interesting, but practically relevant conceptual papers I've seen. It's long, it's intense, but it just keeps delivering gem after gem after gem of insight and perspective. So congrats on a great paper. But I want to first start off with just allowing, before we get into what this paper is about and what it entails, I just want to give you a chance to briefly introduce yourselves. So just a little bit about who you are, where are you, and what, how do you see your research identity at this stage of the game?
Well, I can start. I'm Emily Feldman. I'm the Michael L. Tarnopol Professor and Professor of Management at Wharton. My research identity is all around corporate strategy. So I have devoted a significant amount of time over the past decade plus, I guess, at this point to researching divestitures and currently really seeking to broaden beyond those topics into mergers and acquisitions, obviously our topic here at hand today, as well as many other aspects of corporate governance and corporate strategy and sort of major transactions that companies can undertake.
Awesome. Thank you, Zeke.
Yeah, so I'm Zeke Hernandez. I guess since Emily used her title, I'll use mine. So I'm the Maxim Bernice Garshick Family Presidential Associate Professor, is a very long name chosen by the donor, also at Wharton. And yeah, I study global strategy and corporate strategy. To me, they're actually very related. And I would say perhaps the hallmark of what I do is that it's fundamentally relational in nature. So there's all kinds of external relations that firms have globally in their industry that affect their performance, their decisions. And so I'm interested in those things. And this paper reflects that.
Awesome. So this paper is, it's a big paper. For a conceptual paper, it tackles a lot of different things. And as I was reading it, I was like, well, it probably could have even been two or three papers, but you managed to get it all into one paper. And so now I'm going to give you the challenge of trying to tell me what this paper is about in a relatively short space of time. Some of the listeners will not yet have read it, and they can obviously go and read it. But as a sort of elevator pitch or high-level outline of what this paper is about, how would you explain it in a few sentences or maybe a little longer than that?
Yeah, so I think Emily and I agreed. I try to do this, so let's see how I do. Okay, so I would say that what we're trying to do is to reconceptualize pretty fundamentally the notion of synergy or value coming from mergers and acquisitions. And the reason we did that is because we saw the status quo in the literature on M&A as essentially thinking of synergy coming from two sources, right? One would be like efficiency from improvements in the assets that the two firms own when they combine. The other would be market power from somehow becoming stronger than a competitor or weakening a competitor. And that view is valid and correct, but it's also like at least 30 years outdated. Because, ever since those notions were developed, there's been a lot of research in management and strategy showing that firms also create value from assets that they don't own and control, that they don't govern through competitive interactions, but instead they share them cooperatively with other entities, other firms and organizations in their environment. So, that sounds very abstract, think of alliances, networks, stakeholder relations. That's what we're referring to. And none of those views were incorporated in the canon of synergy and mergers and acquisitions. So we try to do that. And I think we try to do it in three steps. And you're right that each one of these could be its own paper. The first step is develop a new typology of synergies. There are five synergies in our typology: in internal, market power, relational, network, and non-market, or you could think of them as stakeholder. And those last three are the novel ones, the ones that incorporate this external cooperative view of the firm. The first two are the traditional ones that we all know. The second step is to introduce this idea of synergy lifecycle. And the reason we want to do that in the same paper is that if you think about it, different synergies have different timing in terms of when they manifest and how they erode and dissipate over time. And once you start thinking of multiple synergies, you have to think of different life cycles. So that's the second part. And the third part to say, well, if there are multiple synergies, they might complement each other sometimes, or they might undermine each other, what we call co-synergies and dis-synergies. So that's sort of the third concept. The end result of those three would be a more expansive notion of synergy. But what that means is that at the end of the day, the total value that a deal creates is a sum of each individual synergy, the interactions among each of those synergies, and each of them operating on a different clock. That's perhaps longer than a minute, but the best I can do to summarize it.
No, that was great. I mean, just in terms of, because as I said, it is a substantial paper. It says a lot. And I think you did a great job of summarizing it. So who's it for, though? So who are the primary target audiences, and maybe other audiences who might find it interesting or intriguing or find nuggets in what you've done?
Yeah, I can chime in on this one. So, you know, obviously the M&A audience is the biggest one for this, right? I think that makes really good sense. And, you know, what's important about that statement is that, you know, M&A is kind of a mature field. There's lots of research and management and strategy in finance and accounting, right? One of the things that we really worked on in this study was to understand, you know, the breadth of literature that was out there on this topic that's been very well trodden, to make sure that we actually had a contribution that was meaningful and not already done by other scholars in this big body of work. So, you know, I think obviously that M&A community is very important, but I would actually broaden this even beyond that idea as well, and sort of say, well, look, you know, can we think about this from a broader corporate strategy perspective as well, right? So, you know, yes, M&A is the combination of two firms through, you know, that ownership, right? We buy another company, but, you know, as Zeke was talking about before in his description of himself, right, there could be alliances, there could be other modes of corporate development that companies engage in. And so even if we didn't reflect on it explicitly in the paper so much, you know, might there be implications about sources of value perhaps from the different types of synergy that we're talking about for these other kinds of transactions that companies might engage in? And then, you know, I guess the other thing that I would add here is that I think that, you know, we cover a lot of theoretical ground, obviously, in this paper, ranging from, you know, traditional, you know, RBV, IO type of theories, all the way to kind of relational perspectives, non-market stakeholders, you know, networks, all of these different kinds of ideas. So, you know, I think for scholars who are interested in those theories, right, and those bodies as well, I think what's important here is that we articulate how M&A could be a really useful context, perhaps, in which, you know, these types of issues, right, or types of issues that are salient to each of these theories might manifest themselves. So I think from that perspective, this could be really useful to kind of theoretically driven papers that are sort of interested in reflecting on how M&A might be a context. So it kind of works in both directions, M&A as a context in and of itself, but then theory kind of tying back to M&A as a context as well.
The other thing that struck me as I was reading it is that clearly it's got a lot of theoretical, it covers a lot of theoretical ground and incorporates different theoretical perspectives. It's also got this life cycle perspective to it. And there's a whole notion of sort of trade-off and competition in almost in there, but you could, it's not only necessarily valuable to just other scholars. I could envisage this being, there being almost an entire series of MBA classes that explore this, or executive ed discussion for firms that are engaging in M&A to think much more clearly about it. And so have either of you incorporated or experimented with actually trying to take this message to a managerial audience in its current form? And if so, how's it been received?
I definitely have. So my teaching at Wharton is the M&A corporate development elective class here. And so last year, for the first time, once we finally had the paper accepted, I asked my MBA students to read this 113-page monster, exhibits included and appendices included, which they were not thrilled with me about, but nonetheless. And I kind of walked them through this whole framework and made them actually write a reflection paper and discuss it in class, but made them write a reflection paper actually articulating how they might see or have experienced one or more of these types of synergies, the life cycles and the co-synergies and dis-synergies in either their own experience or a deal that they were interested in. So I'm not sure they were thrilled about the workload on this issue, but I think, you know, the feedback that I got on the assignment itself, right, and sort of the value of it was pretty positive, right? I think people, you know, really found it thought provoking to try to understand this idea of synergies, which we talk about pretty extensively, of course, in a class on M&A. So that was one context in which I had the chance to do this. The other is that I actually got to present this in front of a McKinsey audience last year. I will say that they were a little bit more skeptical of this story, in the sense that they are very focused on the idea of kind of synergy as manifestation, right? And we talk about this in the paper, right? So unless we can say it's a revenue synergy or a cost synergy, they're sort of like, well, why do we care about it unless it's kind of showing up on the income statement? So from that perspective, you know, I think there was, you know, maybe a bit of distance between sort of the academics versus the practitioners. But once we got down into sort of the meat of the discussion and sort of started to explain, like, look, no, these are sources of value, and how do we think about that in the context of M&A, I think it was much clearer to them how this could be valuable in terms of advising their clients. So those have been my experiences so far, kind of trying to translate this to practitioner audiences. But I know that, you know, Zeke and I have definitely talked about how it would be great to actually bring this more broadly into kind of the practitioner sphere as a really important extension that a lot of people could benefit from.
Yeah, I mean, I would add something brief here, which is, yes, I think we cared from the outset about the practicality and the usefulness of this framework beyond academia. And managers informed this paper as well. So we don't really reflect that too much in the paper, but we did a lot of background conversations with, you know, the corporate development heads or M&A managers of, you know, firms that and everyone would recognize. And it also became clear to us that, you know, at least speaking for myself, that, you know, some firms actually are incorporating a lot of these ideas, maybe not with the label non-market or relational, but they take it very seriously. And some firms kind of have no clue and are really missing out on understanding this. And so, so the paper was also informed by practice as well. It's not just that we intend it to eventually be useful for practice.
That's very interesting, and it's very useful for our audience of this podcast, is the fact that you're not just theorizing in a vacuum and hoping your ideas have relevance or make sense, but you're doing it, I would expect, both through presenting those ideas to a scholarly audience, but also sharing them with a practitioner audience and seeing what the reception looks like, getting ideas back. And it's this sort of cyclical process that you've alluded to. So can you take me back to, but even back even beyond that, to the genesis of an idea that we need to revisit M&A synergies, or we need to tackle or expand or rethink some of the value that's created or potentially destroyed in the M&A process? And the way to do that is through a conceptual paper. How did that come about? How did the two of you sort of connect on this idea and begin to evolve it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been thinking about this actually, you know, in preparation for this meeting. And It was hard for me to pinpoint like one exact moment. It was certainly a process more than an event. But a few things came to mind. I'd say that this paper is the result of the accumulated research Emily had done for many years. And if you not that you have to, but if you follow our research before this paper, you see that like this is like the reflection of in some ways a lot of our pet peeves and things, frustrations with the literature and things that we've been trying to say. So we felt like we had a lot to say. Right. So it wasn't like, well, let's collaborate on something. What's it going to be? It's like we have all these things to say. Oh, my gosh, we should collaborate. It was more that way. So Emily had done a lot of work on divestitures. I've done a lot of work on, like I said, the relational or cooperative forms of corporate strategy. We had reviewed and read each other's papers over time. And so, that accumulation of ideas led to conversations that resulted in the paper. So there's at least two that I can think of. One is, I remember Emily had been working on a paper and there was one of the things it got at was this idea that when there's a divestiture, when firms break up, undoing the synergies and complementarities that exist in the firm is actually difficult. And so that led us to think of this idea, well, synergies don't last forever. Like, how do they end, right? What's their demise, right? So getting at this, I think, was a kernel of the idea of a life cycle. And then, I had published a series of papers on the idea of network synergies. That is that when firms acquire, part of the reason they do it is to put themselves in a better structural position in the industry alliance network. And it just kind of had bugged me over time that like in the canon of synergy, right, it was all internal, all ownership and control and not relational. And so you can kind of see that some of these things, led to conversations over time and brainstorming. And at some point we started putting pen to paper, literally diagramming things out. I think I'll save some of that for later, but those are some of the origins I remember. Emily, I'm sure that you have maybe different memories.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting. I actually would have said almost exactly the same thing. Like, I definitely remember like the demise of life cycles thing with the divestitures that I had been working on. And I remember reading several of your papers with the network synergies and sort of saying like, wow, we've never thought about this before. So, totally on board with that. I think what was cool is that, and Zeke was kind of alluding to this, like, I just remember like sitting in his office a lot of afternoons, right? Just each of us with like, a yellow pad in front of us and his whiteboard and kind of just debating back and forth about these issues and like saying, well, what about this? And how could we think about that? Right. So, for me, this was really probably one of the like the purest like intellectual experiences that I've had as a scholar, right? Whereas like we're actually like just really engaged with the ideas, right? And we don't have like a super fixed agenda of where we want to go with this, but here are a lot of issues that we find really interesting that our work has spoken to in the past and that we think we could kind of join forces together and create a synergy with, right? So I think that was a bit of the zeitgeist, I guess, behind the story. So
yeah.
Can you give us a sense of timing there? So how long did you, I don't want obviously the whole backstory because I realize that this paper does build on both of your work. But once you started to coalesce and engage in some intellectual back and forth about what's going on here, how long did that go on before you began to draft and actually put things down and begin to form something that resembled a manuscript? And then how long did it take to submit to a journal? And then how long did you have to go through the R&R process? Just to give a sense for those who have never done this before, what that time frame can look like.
I can take a stab at least at the first part of it. So I remember very clearly that we started working together in the spring. I don't remember which year, but I know it was in the spring semester because I kind
2017.
Okay, you're better than I am, Zeke, on the memory there. Spring 2017. And I feel like, those discussions that I was just talking to were kind of that spring, very much. And then I would say that we probably had a manuscript drafted, like an initial manuscript, probably by the end of that summer, because I remember that we presented the paper in a brown bag at Wharton that fall, a very hotly debated brown bag as well. So that was that fall of 2017. My memory starts to get a little bit hazy after that, so I'm going to pass it off to Zeke on this point, but that's at least my recollection of kind of the early phases of kind of the timeline there.
Yeah. I think, again, this is, our memories are fallible, so I'm sure this isn't perfectly accurate. But by that fall, right, this brown bag paper we presented, definitely the typology of five synergies was there. And there was a, I would say, a half-baked or half-developed idea of life cycles. The part of like co-synergies, dis-synergies was not there at that point. So then from the feedback we got, I remember there were some conferences that Emily and I knew, we were going to have in spring. So think May 2018. So our goal was like for those conferences, we'll have a brand new draft. And so I remember coming back from those conferences at around May 2018 with a lot of very good feedback. And then, we did a lot of updates to the paper and submitted probably late summer, early fall of 2018. So think about year and a half after we started really working on it. And then the review process was lengthy, right? We had two really big revisions, but the first one, the editor, I was going to save this for later. The editor wanted us to do a systematic literature review, which for the audience members, that might sound, no, it's just like a background literature. No, systematic literature review is actually like a methodology, like it's a formal methodology to do a literature review, which neither of us had done before. And so that took a long time. So I think the first round of revisions took us a bit over 6 months or so, Emily, maybe up to 9 months. It was long. The rest were shorter. So I would say 2 years under review. Anyway, that was the journey. Yeah.
Yeah. It just gives someone who hasn't done this a good sense. And I think it highlights a few important things that you did. I think number one, we've already doubled down on it or double clicked on it, is you're building on knowledge that you've evolved and developed and are familiar with at the time that you enter into this collaboration. Number two, there is this period of time where it's just sort of intellectual exploration and not knowing exactly where you're going, but almost the longer you engage in that, the more these insights and perspectives are allowed to emerge. But you can't engage in that forever. You've got to eventually put a line in the sand and say, okay, well, we're going to write something now. And I think there's huge value in understanding that it's important to get those ideas out in front of people, an audience that are going to be critical, that are going to stretch you, that are going to poke holes in some of your thinking, but also challenge certain things, but also give you feedback of things that might work. And using that as a mechanism to keep moving forward, and then give yourself other intermittent deadlines. Otherwise, you can just sit on things for ages. So we're going to go out to those spring conferences. We're going to present, get more feedback, and get the idea out. So I think those are hugely valuable insights for someone who's trying to embark on developing a very substantive conceptual paper.
Greg, could I add something if that's okay? I know that I think it's getting at the question or the topic here, but just getting a bit to the origins and the process. I mean, I think I agree with Emily that this was one of the more, what I would consider like pure creation, right? As close as I've gotten to like just really diving into ideas, fundamentally new ideas. As opposed to like, well, we kind of have this hypothesis, let's see what the data says, right? Because with the theory paper, you don't have, the data in some ways are really nice because they constrain you, right? With the theory paper, you can endlessly like add and never stop. So one thing about the process that I think is interesting is that we spent most of the time and most of the thinking was in drawing diagrams and creating tables and rewriting table and recreating tables and reorganizing tables, right? The thinking was sort of at the level of like, think of like the tables and figures in the paper, right? The paper has several of them. And it was like, that's where the creation happened. And then so we focused on getting those right, because we knew that the thinking would be tight if we could conceptualize it in a table or a diagram. And then the writing was much easier. So what I mean is that my advice, you know, perhaps for someone trying to tackle an AMR paper would be like, you know, focus on the tables and figures and then do the writing rather than starting to write paragraphs, right? Because you'll just never stop. The thinking doesn't become so tight. In fact, I have, I was looking this up. So I have, this is on my phone here, but I remember this, I don't know if this will be very visible here on the screen, but this is like a 3x5. I don't know if you see it. It's like a 3x5 early prototype of one of the tables, right? And you can see that it's messy and it's not very clean. And of course, you know, it's not at all what ended up in the paper, but just to show that, you know, that's how the process works. It's just messy and a lot of back and forth.
When Zeke found that that image, which is my horrible handwriting, I'll fess up to it right now. He texted it to me, and I think that was probably one of my favorite texts of the past year. Actually, just as like a throwback, like, wow, like this is where this all came from a million years ago. So yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. And I think that's such good just prompting and advice is the relevance of organizing thoughts and putting them down on paper and evolving them in that sort of figures and tables format. And then it becomes easier to write around those things, and you're constrained by what's there and what's represented, as opposed to just writing paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. So that's very helpful and useful. What kept you interested? Was there anything that was sort of pulling you along or dragging you along, or that you really felt compelled to go? Or was it just the idea that, oh, we can get a paper out there?
I can start on this, right? So I think it was a couple of things for me, right? So first is I love working with Zeke. I think Zeke is great. So co-author admiration here was definitely a big motivation. So that was one thing. I think the other, though, I think there's probably two or three. So let me kind of take them one at a time. So I think another big one for me is that, so Zeke was mentioning these systematic lit reviews, right? And I think that was an incredibly hard, but an incredibly valuable exercise because, you know, against this huge backdrop of this enormous literature on M&A, it really became apparent that there was a there, which I think is not always the case. Like, you know, you can kind of stretch and you can argue maybe in certain papers that there's a gap and you're doing something. And, you know, sometimes it's more true than others and fine. But, you know, I think in this one, it was just like so clear to me when we did these two systematic lit reviews, that there actually really was sort of something missing that we could valuably fill with the ideas that we had, was a real motivator for me to really want to do this, right? Because it was like, well, actually, you know, it's not about a paper, right? Who cares about a paper? It's actually like we really can advance this body of research in a way that hasn't been done before, right? So I think that was one thing that really, you know, definitely, you know, kind of kept my interest and my attention on this paper. The other thing I'll mention is that, you know, I was talking before about kind of sources of synergy versus manifestations of synergy, and this was certainly heightened in the practitioner discussions that we had in both developing the paper, but then also even after the fact. You know, we actually do think too much about these manifestations of synergy. Like, why are we constraining ourselves to only thinking about synergy in terms of its impact on a company's income statement? Like, why don't we actually reflect on, you know, where synergies come from in a serious way? And, you know, I'm sure Zeke will echo this as well, but like, why don't we think about these cooperative or relational or external perspectives in a more systematic way than we do, right? So I think, you know, just sort of see, and this is connected to the systematic lit review point, but just sort of seeing like that emphasis on manifestations rather than sources, you know, also made me really want to kind of go further with this and say, okay, well, what are the sources? Like, can we actually do this? You know, and I think finally, you know, the last thing I'll say here is, you know, I almost viewed this as kind of field building, and maybe this was just a phase of career kind of thing where, you know, I guess I feel some sort of responsibility to kind of shape the trajectory at this stage of my professional life. But, you know, yeah, like, what is the next 20 years of M&A research going to look like? What is the next 20 years of corporate strategy research going to look like? You know, can we advance this, you know, foundational theoretical article, you know, a la Dyer and Thing relational view or something like that, that sort of sets the stage for a huge amount of work to follow, right? So I think that that was definitely a piece of that for me as well, just being able to, you know, guide the conversation in a way that I thought was meaningful and important. So those are my thoughts on this issue of, you know, what kept me interested in it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great aspiration. You know, we can do that.
Well, I wanted to say, yeah, just in response to that, that's what I felt like I was reading, was like, okay, I'm seeing a bit of I'm getting a sense of where M&A research is going to go. And so it is interesting to have these sort of grander aspirations and to and I think it's valuable. We need people to have those in the field, and that's certainly the kind of papers that AMR wants to be publishing. So I think it's commendable to sort of own up to that and to say, yes, we that's what we were intending to do, because I certainly think that's the sense that you get from the paper. Zeke, did you want to add anything that was sort of keeping you motivated throughout? I interrupted there a little, so I apologize.
No, not at all. No, and thank you. You've been so kind in what you've said about the paper. I think having a good co-author, you know, that works hard and sort of matches your intensity in some ways is great. I think Emily and I have that, but I think also, you know, we kind of joked as we were presenting around that this is like a paper on synergies with a lot of synergies among the co-authors, right? Because I think Emily and I came from different but complementary backgrounds. And so I always felt like, oh, wow, I'm learning from what she is contributing. And I, you know, I hope it went the other way too as well. So that I just want to echo that really matters. I think the other thing really keeps me going with this paper and others is like when I feel like I myself am learning a lot as I go, right? So like I can honestly say that I learned a lot about synergy and corporate strategy writing the paper, you know, as opposed to like, well, we all knew this, and I just packaged it in a certain way. And so I think the learning really kept us going. And then, you know, this is more after the paper was submitted. I would say that we had a very good, editor and reviewer team overall. And by that, I don't mean easy. They were certainly not easy. We had to do an incredible amount of work, but they were tough in the right direction. But there was a sense that, I mean, you know, there's always the reviewer two joke, and we certainly had some of that. But overall, like, there was a sense that they believed in this, that they were contributing ideas that were making the paper better. So that's also very motivating, because you're not getting like only negativity back. So I think the review process was also constructive.
So you alluded to the two systematic literature reviews that you were required to do. And I noticed in the paper that you call them out, and you sort of, there's a lot of work that's gone into those, but they don't consume the paper. It's not an annals piece. But were there any other things that were sort of fairly significant shifts in the R&R process? So in revising the paper in response to that can just sort of give us a sense of what that back and forth might have looked like and why you needed to invest so much in the revisions.
So I have an initial thought I can start, and I don't mean to take the mic, Zeke, so feel free to chime in or interrupt me on any of this. But, you know, I think for me in the review process, probably the biggest like quantum leap forward for me was figure one. And, you know, Zeke's picture that he showed on his cell phone was the early prototype for figure one. But I think that actually it was reviewer one who really pushed us on this, as I recall. So
yes.
He or she really, you know, just articulated, I think, what we sort of wanted to say, you know, in just like a really like helpful way, or like gave us at least the boundaries of like, you know, what those two dimensions of that figure might be the levels of analysis and the governance orientation. And I think, you know, kind of working through and developing that organizing framework, like Zeke was saying before, and sort of having that as like, actually, this is what we're trying to say here, right? Like, we actually are introducing this cooperative governance orientation relative to what already existed on the internal and the competitive one, and then also sort of thinking about the levels of analysis point in a more systematic way, I think was a huge step forward for me, at least, I think, in the review process, right? I just sort of feel like the paper fundamentally changed once we got that feedback from that reviewer and sort of implemented it in terms of actually doing the figure itself in the paper. So, I mean, that's one I can talk more, but I think that was probably the biggest one for me in terms of the foundational shift of the paper through the review process.
So just to unpack that a little bit and try and understand a little bit more, because what I'll put the figure up while we're talking about this in the actual video. So did you have a sense that there were these five different elements, but you hadn't fully organized them according to those dimensions, and the reviewer provided a stronger sense of how what the dimensions might capture? Or did the reviewer actually provide the essence of, these are the five elements? So just help us understand what the reviewer provided there, because I think it's interesting to know.
Yeah, definitely. So we had the five synergy types, right? I think we knew that we had the types of synergies. That was definitely there. I think that the dimensions were really kind, and I don't recall, pardon me, I don't recall if he actually said like, oh, governance orientation levels of analysis, or if we kind of came up with that ourselves. Maybe it was a little bit of both, actually. I really don't remember. But, you know, I think the idea even maybe that we should have an organizing framework to kind of pull those together and, you know, whatever the dimensions were, right? Maybe it was more loose and we could figure it out and this is what we came up with. But yeah, I think that was kind of the key piece there that you see, right? So those two axes, right, I guess is the real contribution.
Yeah, because I mean, if you think about it, I think the way we had first presented the five is like, well, there's these five, right? And they each tie to a literature, right? So, you know, like the non-market synergies tied to like stakeholder theory and, you know, network synergy to obviously network theories, et cetera. But it's like, well, you know, I mean, in some ways, what we weren't clear about, well, how do you know there aren't six or seven or four or one or, right? Like, what is the framework that tells you that it's these five and that's kind of a comprehensive and systematic set? And so I think that's what those two dimensions do. I mean, one thing that, for example, just to illustrate why that's so important, I wish we could redraw figure one a little bit, is that if you think of like, you look at the intersection of, since you said you're going to put this figure up, you look at the intersection of fiat and the levels of analysis, fiat only exists at the firm level of analysis, and at every other level, it's an empty set, right? You cannot have fiat in the other four levels of analysis. And so that's just one example of how with these two dimensions, it just makes it very clear why those synergies exist and why it's those five in a systematic way, right? And so I would agree with Emily that was probably the biggest thing. There were other changes that I guess I'm happy to talk about, but I agree that was the big one probably, yeah.
One or two others, whichever you feel are salient, Zeke, I'd love for you to just chat about one or two others.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the first version of the paper didn't have any propositions. You know, I know that propositions are a very like traditional thing in AMR papers, and we didn't want to straitjacket it into it. But there was one section on life cycles where it did make sense to have them, right? Because we had presented these life cycles, and we have a figure there where we draw life cycle shapes. But it was a little ad hoc in terms of like, well, but where do they come from? Like, what determines that, say, you know, network synergies manifest quicker than relational synergies? Like, you know, what are the variables that would tell us that happens? And I think the reviewers, you know, rightly so insisted and or at least suggested that we should have those. So that helped us come up with like variables, you know, like things that you could turn on and off that would change the shape of these life cycles. And I think that was a good improvement.
While you're talking about propositions, I want to encourage people to go and read the paper. But one of the things that is in the paper is you've got propositions, but then you've also got empirical predictions.
Yes.
And so can you tell us a little bit about how you arrived at the idea of empirical predictions in addition to propositions, how you view them as each contributing something separate to the paper and moving it forward?
Yeah, so I would say that the propositions are more general theoretical conceptual things that explain, like, they're like the dimensions in the figure we were just talking about, right? The dimensions that explain why concepts are separate, right? And also, like, those propositions are, they tie back. So the reason why that figure one was so fundamental is that those propositions tie directly back to those two dimensions, right? They explain how, like, the governance orientation affects the control a firm has, which affects the timing of the erosion of synergies, and the level of analysis relates to the need for integration, which affects the initial realization. So these propositions create a theoretical thread that unites everything, right? But they're more conceptual in nature, whereas empirical propositions would be, I see them as things that you could empirically test. So it was important for us to be like, okay, if you were to empirically test certain ideas, some of them are more testable than others. And those empirical propositions are the most testable. But also they're less, I would think of them as less universal, right? They're more like specific to a certain situation or firm or a certain type of synergy. Whereas the what we're calling the propositions are more generalizable and help us explain the differences across the synergies rather than being very particular. I don't know if that made sense, but Emily, maybe you can say it better than I did.
Yeah, this was actually going to be one of the things that I was going to talk about if I had the chance here. But yeah, I mean, I think the idea of sort of developing the propositions was really important in terms of sort of how the paper evolved. But what I was going to say is that, yeah, the distinction between sort of the propositions versus the testable predictions was really important in the sense of saying, well, you know, yeah, if we're looking at what might lead to variance in one of these life cycles, right? There's, like Zeke was saying, kind of the conceptual effect, right, which is fine and is sort of out there. And yes, that, you know, this should amplify, the magnitude of the curve or something like that, and that's fine. But, you know, for a researcher that, you know, wants to, you know, hold on to something tangible, like, we really wanted to kind of give that example of, what one of those factors might be, right? And so I think that's really, you know, the genesis of the empirical predictions. You know, one thing I will say that I think is probably somewhat unique, although I don't know if this is true for sure, but, you know, that idea of distinguishing between propositions and empirical predictions actually came, I believe, in the third round of review, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right, Zeke? It actually came very, very late in the process.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that's really important, actually, because it just shows, like, how our thinking evolved, first of all, in and of itself, but then also how, you know, the reviewers kind of kept shaping the paper and kept pushing us to really, you know, take it that one mile further than we already had, right? And so, you know, no question it was challenging, right? But I think it really, really made the paper better along that dimension to sort of say, like, well, yeah, like, really, if you wanted to give something to an empirical researcher to do, like, what would it be? And how could that be, you know, sort of an example or, you know, a subset or, you know, one manifestation of sort of the broader proposition that you laid out earlier in the paper. So that's what I would add to this point.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's really valuable just from a pure theoretical conceptual writing standpoint, because there's often this trade-off between being incredibly conceptual and theoretical in your propositions, but then there's also this notion, well, could you ever test that? What would it look like? It feels too far from the empirical realm to ever transition from that into. And then you face the trade-off that if you make your proposition that you're claiming too tied to something specific, that it's then not theoretical enough. So you've navigated that by having these two different sort of artifacts or apparatus in the paper, And I think it works really, really well here. So I like it. And I think other people will borrow that idea going forward.
We hope so. Yeah. You can maybe edit this out if it doesn't work, but if I had to restate a bit the distinction we were getting at, I think of, in our literatures, there are these big concepts that they're like really important, but you can't really touch them, right? So think of like absorptive capacity or the demand curve or, these things that are like really important to building a coherent theory, but they're not observable. So what do we really test? We test other things that are consistent with the demand curve or consistent with absorptive capacity. And so again, I'm not trying to claim that our concepts are as foundational as those, but I'm just trying to explain the role that we hope they play. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's great. So did you begin, and just for clarification, did you begin with this as having the three different elements, the typology, the life cycle elements, and then the final piece? Or did it evolve into those three in some format as you went forward?
Yes. So the first submission to AMR had all three. But obviously, as you can already tell, it changed, like the emphasis changed. And the so, for example, we were just talking about propositions. Actually, if I remember right, Emily, the section on co-synergies and dissynergies had propositions at the beginning, yeah. And then ended up without them. And the section on life cycles, I believe, didn't and ended up with them. And then, of course, as Emily mentioned, the typology didn't have those two dimensions to motivate it. For example, we realized that the co-synergy, dissynergy idea, even though it's important and we're glad it's there and we think it belongs there, it was the most raw. There wasn't very much prior literature to focus on. If you read the paper, you see that we have a systematic literature review for the typology, right, which is the literature review on kind of synergy and value and M&A. And then we have a systematic literature review on post-merger integration, which is a motivation for the life cycle part. But we don't have a systematic literature review on co-synergies and dissynergies because that idea, like there's no prior literature on it. And so that's the most speculative part of the paper. And, as we thought about it, but also as the reviewers were pointing out things, we realized, that's one where we just can't go too far. That one we do have to leave at a bit of a higher level and hope that future research deepens it. So yes, everything was there, but it didn't look like it does today. Yeah.
And can you talk to me a little bit about the decision to incorporate this case study at the end? I guess it's probably going to be as an appendix of sorts, where you apply the framework to the well-trodden area of the airline industry. Was that in the paper and you were forced to pull it out, or were you asked to incorporate some more pragmatic example, or how did you arrive at the point where you've got this case study at the end in which you apply the core framework to the airline industry?
I can take a pass at this. So this was a really interesting thing. So I do believe that the reviewers were kind of pushing us to have like some illustration of what we were talking about. So I think that was certainly part of it. But I think what was actually even the more salient driver here is, and I'll give my shout out. So one of the practitioners that read this paper was the head of McKinsey's post-merger integration practice, a very dear friend of mine named Oliver Engert, who's brilliant, but was extremely skeptical about this this framework, right? So he literally, this very busy, very busy and important man read this entire manuscript or an early version of it and handed me back handwritten comments on, all 65 pages of this thing. And one of his things that he kept writing throughout the manuscript actually was, because I guess he had advised a lot of these companies perhaps in his work, right? But airlines, like this happened in Delta Northwest, or this didn't happen in United Continental. And so, and he actually like in the follow-up conversation that he and I had about this, about the paper and the feedback that he was giving us was, why don't you actually write like a mini case study that, brings together some of these points, right? So, he was super, super influential, like reviewer number four or something like that in incorporating this into the paper. And, we did tons of research, of course, like even beyond what he had written, and to find examples and really to make it, you know, cover the entire breadth of what we were talking about in the paper with the co-synergies and the dis-synergies and the life cycles and everything like that. But I think his influence was really, a very salient piece of the development of that case study. You know, as for the question of, you know, why didn't we put it in the paper itself and kind of have it at the end? You know, I think it was, you know, sort of AMR's theory conceptual, and, you know, this is, you know, an illustration and it's super helpful, but maybe not a great fit for like the body of the paper itself. So that was probably the biggest driver, as I recall, at least in terms of the decision of where to place it. But, you know, I just think it's like a really useful like illustration of these things. And I know it's helpful, like, especially in teaching with the MBA students or with executives, like, hey, look, here is like just, you know, very tangible illustration in a context that everyone knows about, that sort of shows a lot of these points. So that's my recollection of that piece of the paper.
Yeah, I mean, very quickly, the only thing I'd add is the decision of where to put it came very late. In fact, the managing editor of the paper for the paper, the AMR, so not even the associate editor, but the person who does the, you know, manages the copy editing and all that, we initially had it in an appendix, and I think he even sort of suggested, well, maybe, you know, interestingly, I this is uncommon, but he kind of suggested it, and we wanted something because it's easy to get, there's so many parts in this paper, we wanted something that kind of showed how the whole thing fits together. So that's what we hope the case study does.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was sort of playing mental games with myself. If I was teaching a corporate strategy class or class in M&As, how could I rework the case study so I hide some of the terms and get the students to think through it all? And then I come out with these wonderful tables and diagrams that explain everything that's going on in really pragmatic sense. But I've gotten them into the mindset of mergers and acquisitions and why they might happen using the case study. So it is a very useful tool. So what next? You've already alluded to the fact that, you know, we would all like to write the field defining manuscript, but sort of immediate next steps, either for yourselves or for others, where do you hope this paper will have an impact next? And pragmatically, how might people use it to either spur research or to prompt them to further conceptualize ideas? What are your thoughts or ideas around where it might go next?
Yeah, do you want me to start on this one, Emily? So, I mean, look, I mean, obviously, it would be our wildest dream if this becomes sort of the framework on synergy and value for the next, 20 years. We would love that. But we would love it to be used by researchers, managers, all kinds of practitioners. So I can think of a few examples, right? So I'll start with, I guess since mostly academics will be listening to it, I'll start with researchers, but I also want to give a few managerial applications. I think if you're a researcher, and Emily alluded to this before, even if you're not necessarily an M&A or a corporate strategy researcher, we hope this paper suggests a ton of avenues for future empirical work. For example, almost nobody has quantified the existence of relational synergies or non-market synergies, right? There is some work on network synergies. Selfishly, it's, my own, but nobody besides me, right? And so, there's still a lot of empirical just testing and validation of the framework. So, doctoral student looking for a first year paper, why not, right? We would love for someone to test and maybe refute or validate that these synergies exist. As far as we know, nobody has really studied the timing of synergies, right? The initial realization, the eventual erosion in particular. So there's a lot to study in terms of just the timing of when value is created and eroded or destroyed by mergers and acquisitions. So the idea of timing and corporate strategy is pretty much missing. So we hope this paper spurs perhaps a subfield of timing. And also, nobody's looked at the interactions across different sources of value, whether positive or negative interactions. So there's just a ton of empirical work. For full disclosure, Emily and I, along with Kate Ojemkowska, we have a paper we're trying to document stakeholder synergies. But, there's a lot, and we're not going to be able to do it all. So that's on the academic side.
So while we're there, Zeke, are there obvious empirical settings. We see here you sort of allude to, well, the airlines is one place where we've seen this, but are there, you're much closer to it, the two of you. So just to give people a sense of which other industries or industry settings could one look at as obvious places to go and try and explore this?
Yeah. So, I mean, to be clear also, we don't believe that all five synergies are equally important in all settings. So that's not our point. It would be foolish to believe that. But, you know, because the new synergies are the more relational, external, cooperative ones right now, I would think look to industries where resources and knowledge are widely distributed, right? Where a firm can't go it alone, so to speak. So, you know, tech industries, pharma, biotech, airlines, of course, is an obvious one. A lot of these new age, you know, platform kind of industries. So, you know, where resources aren't, you can't own the full stack of resources you need. I think those are perfect settings. I would say for the stakeholder or non-market synergies, any kind of socially controversial or contested environment, is one where you're going to see a lot of the importance of these non-market ESG type, effects. That's where I would look for the new stuff. But I think for the issue of timing and co-synergy, dis-synergy, really any sector where M&A happens, because nobody studied that.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you. Sorry to have interrupted, but I wanted to get that while we were hot on the tail.
No, that's great. Emily, am I talking too much, or do I have time for just...
No,
so on the practitioner side, I mean, obviously I'm very interested and passionate about this, but here's one, I think, to me, one very concrete example. So think of a manager or an analyst that's doing the typical net present value valuation of a deal. Okay. So again, if our framework were correct, and we hope it is, then what does that mean? It means that your NPV analysis needs to incorporate a lot of new things, right? Because you might do revenue cost, or you might be thinking of market power and internal stuff. But if you're not thinking about all the external relationships that are combined by the deal, right, the alliances, the networks, the stakeholder coalitions, all of a sudden, you have to think of how to incorporate that in your cash flow projections, right? So it broadens your NPV analysis. You also have to think about the risk, right? The discount rate is going to be a function of like the co-synergies and particularly dis-synergies. And that's true for whether you're an analyst or a manager. So I would say like the whole field of M&A valuation, if you take our framework seriously, would change in a pretty important way. And in fact, you would need to even develop new measures of value that go beyond just say accounting profits or something like that.
I can see it exploding some of our our MBA's heads as they start thinking about the timing and everything.
Yeah, I want to know what Emily says. So I'll
we're on a path to wrap up here. But Emily, anything that strikes you as maybe you can just throw out a few nuggets there for those who want to build on this.
Yeah, for sure. No, I mean, I completely echo Zeke on many of the things that he said. But yeah, I mean, look at the range of, I mean, this is what's cool about this paper, right? Like I said at the very beginning, this is a field that's super well trodden, right? But look at all the things that haven't been done, right? Like even the insight, like Zeke said, that we actually don't really have like a serious quantification of relational synergies. Okay, well, you know, I think that's a pretty important point, right? Like where do, you know, how can we actually see that value creation from these, right? Even if you don't take the whole synergy or the whole framework as a whole, right? I think just the idea of sort of looking at these individual pieces, like this is how a field advances, right? So I just think that's a really important point. And then, yeah, I mean, there's all these insights. Like I can tell you, like when I was presenting our work with the McKinsey people, like they were crazy for the idea of, you know, dis-synergies, right? They were like, oh, this is super important. Like we need to have this quantified, like this would be so valuable for clients, right? So, you know, both from an academic perspective and a practitioner perspective, like, yeah, why don't we have a serious quantification of dis-synergies, right? I did it in my work on divestitures, but isn't there a really, really serious way to grapple with this and to kind of measure these kinds of ideas empirically in the context of M&A, right? So, I really echo Zeke, like I said, right, that we have a ton more work to do, which is pretty exciting given the maturity of this field, right? So, you know, for us, right, I mean, I think it's great that we've already started, you know, getting to work on some of these topics ourselves. And, you know, that's super cool. And it's neat to kind of put the framework into action in our own research. But, you know, I guess I just really, you know, encourage everyone else to do the same, right? Because I think there's lots of opportunities here.
Well, I think two underlying messages for everyone out there. If you haven't read the paper, go and download it from AMR and read it. And secondly, if you're doing a doctoral seminar in the next few years and you don't include this, you're doing a disservice to your students. So congrats on a great paper. Thank you for being so open about the development and evolution of it. And I think it's a great contribution to both the literature and for us at AMR in terms of our origin series. So thank you to both of you.
Thank you, Greg.
Thanks, Greg.